Running a con should be boring. However, immediately following this panel, not sure if it's in this room, there is a...
It's in this room.
Okay,
and it's probably going to be even more boring.
Yep, so after this panel will be a panel on con ops.
Let's try this.
After this panel, there will be a panel on con ops by that person. So, you know, we'll see which one of these is the most boring panel. Hopefully they're both boring, because running a con should be a boring endeavor. If it gets really exciting, something has gone wrong. And the way I do this panel, by the way, my name is Giza. I have been staffing cons for, with it being 2024, I've been staffing cons for officially 25 years now. I've been staffing cons for a quarter century. I've worked in various positions. I've been on the boards of a couple of cons. I was on AmphioCon's board for a decade and a half, and I'm currently serving a two-year term on the board for Minnesota Furs, which runs furry migration up in Minneapolis. And the way I do this panel is I kind of have a list of things that all go down, but that's not really an exhaustive list, because that would take way longer than an hour. And also, like, as questions come up, I do encourage people to just raise their hand, you know, if I say something you want to know more about or a related question, just jump in with a question, and it was kind of the conversation going that direction. And this is also why I don't have a presentation, because no two instances of this panel are the same. Hi! Bye. All right, we're up one person. So let's see, where to start? Usually where I start this panel off, the very first topic is I start with, how do you know if it's time to have a con? Like if you have a critical mass for a convention in your area, and one way to do it is you can start off really, really small by holding something like a bowling beach or a picnic. Those things are just a couple hours of effort. Your staff might be like half a dozen people. It's very low risk, very low cost. Things go well, great, that paves the road for expansion. If things go less well, you're not risking a whole lot of money that way. Because I do want to emphasize conventions are serious business, because they are, in most cases, a business in the eyes of the law. And if things go wrong, I've seen a couple of cases where a con chair has been sued by their venue for five figures successfully. You don't want that to happen. I know of one con chair who might be going to prison. You definitely don't want that to happen. Don't go to prison. So let me just go down my notes here. Is there any topic that anyone really wants me to talk about? I saw a hand.
Kind of. I really like the idea of like a critical mass, but maybe also finding a venue that's suitable for a convention, what are the parameters involving that, and ways to kind of gauge whether or not you have enough people to make essentially ends meet.
Second, let me see if I can do this with the N95 on. Does this work for everyone? I feel stupid, but if I sound good, I'll take it. So the question was, how to determine if you critical mass, and you said like a checklist for a venue as well?
Yeah.
So one really good sign for a venue is, has this venue hosted other cons? And this is a thing I noticed in the Midwest. There are some hotels, like the MFF Hotel is a good example. It's a Hyatt Regency. And the Furry Migration Hotel, which is also a Hyatt Regency. And Yes, that's a pattern. Those are hotels that have hosted numerous cons, science fiction cons, gaming cons, general geek cons. If you see a hotel that has hosted cons, chances are they're going to be very friendly towards you. And you can do a little networking. You can reach out to the convention organizers and say, of this existing cons, and say, hi, I'm thinking about holding a con. Could you introduce me to someone from the sales staff at the hotel? And that's known as a warm introduction. When you get introduced through someone, it kind of elevates you a little because another person is introducing you and saying, like, hey, I know this person. They're all right, versus just essentially cold calling them, which is a cold introduction. As far as critical mass for numbers, that gets into, like, what are you looking to do? Are you looking to do a bowling beat? You know, you can do that with three or four people, potentially. Are you looking to do a full-blown, you know, 3 or 4 day convention like this one? If you're expecting a smaller turnout, you're looking at a few dozen staff. I know MFF, I think we have like 400 staff this year. I think AmpliCon is about 300 staff. But those are five-figure conventions. MFF's attendance is, I believe, 13,000 ACs, which also a little less than 13,000.
Go ahead. Pardon me, when you say figure, do you mean the cost to hold it? Or?
I was just talking in terms of staffing numbers. Oh, when I said figure, I meant for attendance.
Oh, sure.
I meant for attendance. AC had about 13,000. I think MFS was a higher 13,000. I don't remember the exact number. It's a big number. So,
it was about like
15,000. Yeah. It could have been. I staffed MFF. I don't remember much from that con. Pull up my notes again. It depends. Staff numbers depend on what sort of attendance you're looking at. And the first year con is easily going to be under 1,000 people. And that brings us to the topic of recruiting staff. One way you can recruit staff is network, network, network. And one way to make staff friends is to staff other cons. And I've gotten to staff cons by staffing another con. And so I'll be like, hey, I'm running this con. Would you like to attend? We need staff people. And those of us who staff cons serially, like I said, I've been doing it for a quarter of a century. So yes, I have a problem, but it's a good kind of problem to have. And you know, if someone says like, hey, I'm running this con, are you interested in helping out? I'll probably say yes, because we're gluttons for punishment.
Sure. Sorry, I'm asking so many questions.
No, that's, I want y'all to ask questions. Please follow this person's example and ask questions.
So I know a lot of the incentive to staff is to, you know, be a part of this community that, you know, does a thing like this for, you know, the greater furry community. Because I see there are A&E staff and A&E volunteers. Is staff like a paid position, essentially? Or is it more a volunteer?
Oh, you got paid. No, I've never been paid a dime in terms of actual, like cash to staff the con.
Sure.
What larger cons will sometimes do, if the budgets permit, is they'll pick up hotel rooms. So, like, this con has staff hotel rooms for the staff who are working year-round. We call that core staff. And there's maybe a couple dozen of us, and we're like four in a room, sort of arrangement. Other cons will do different things. I've seen some cons offer discount hotel rooms to their staff. Sometimes what a con will do, just get into hotel contracts for a minute, and I'll come back to the staffing, the rooming thing. When you're hosting an event at a hotel, you generally get a discount on the room rate. So rooms might be like, say, $250 a night, but the attending rate might be, say, $200 a night. And the reason for that is what you do is you sign a contract with the hotel where you're guaranteeing them a certain number of room nights. For a larger cause, it's well into the thousands of room nights. You say, we're going to fill this many rooms for this many nights, and the hotel says, great, and they will lower the rate for you. And sometimes the contracts will offer some strange incentives, like you get the convention will get a room night credit for like every 50 or 100 room nights. So if you've got 1,000 room nights and every 50 room nights is one room night credit, the con now has 20 room nights at its disposal during the event, and those can help sometimes turn into staff rooms. And what I've seen, AmpliCon in particular, is an interesting thing. That Westin in Pittsburgh, every hotel in here from that Westin in Pittsburgh has quarter suites. And often a department head will get a corner suite. The con will provide that with its room night credits, and the department head, it's up to them how they fill that, and each department does their own thing. So AmpliCon's a little more distributed, but like MFF, it's done usually through the con. And sometimes what cons will do is offer a staff block for booking rooms, where like staff gets early shot and a separate block, and then there's then something like dealer block, super sponsor block, and then attendee block. And again, every con is different. You were getting back to, I think, does that cover your housing question for staff?
Or? It does. The question was geared towards what's the incentive for to someone for staff, essentially, like how would I recruit?
Free membership to
Yeah.
Larger cons will also do things like a staff party of some sort. Like this con in its earlier years would have like a staff pizza fee. We'd order pizzas on Sunday night. I think this year we're having our first staff party because we've grown in size and we're bringing in more revenue. There may or may not be room night credits stuff that I mentioned involved. Other things for staff at most cons will get like a shirt. Sometimes I'd say there's a sponsor line, staff for like dealers room staff are allowed to avail themselves of that and similar perks. Something Anthrocon does, because it is in downtown Pittsburgh, it's like businesses all over the place, we negotiate with the various local eateries. We get certificates, gift certificates made up where it's like, here's a $10 voucher for whatever venue, like Fernando's or Pizza Parma or whatever. We give each of the staff some of those, and then we then reimburse the venue for however many were used. That's less of an option, say, this hotel, because there's, I think there's a Dunkin' Donuts down the street, but there's a little less to walk to, and I don't think any of us want to walk in 29-degree weather anyway. You know, MFF's another example for those that have been to MFF. There are a couple of venues inside the hotel, but it's not like you're going to go out and walk down the street because it's December. Any related questions before I, yes?
How do you deal with financing in the early years of the convention?
Ooh, that's a good question. Financing, I think you're kind of getting into bootstrapping, it sounds like for year zero maybe?
Yeah.
So when you were trying to bootstrap for year zero, remember the part where I said bowling meet? That's one way to raise money, because bowling meets it. You know, let's say the lane wants $11 a bowler, and if you charge $15 or $20 a bowler, people will pay that. And now you just made a profit, which you can then use as seed funding. And I think this con was born out of bowling meets in a similar manner. You can do other things as well, like that, picnics. Donations gets a little trickier, because that starts to sound like almost an unregistered stock offering, and there's definitely legal implications. You definitely, in any case, in any state, speak to an attorney who is licensed in your state, and we have early attorneys. The most famous one is Boozy Badger. If you reach out to him, he can give you a reference, because Furry Lawyer Twitter exists. There's a whole collection of furry lawyers. As far as other finance things, once you start to get to like year one, year two, year three, the formula I've seen for a lot of cons is you look at the past year's attendance and you budget for that for the next year. You assume that you're going to get exactly the same number of attendees of last year. That becomes your next year's budget. So if you go over that, you have a surplus, and hopefully you don't have a contraction in attendance. So that's very rare, especially with how the furry community is growing. I think every con in the last year post-COVID has shown quite substantial growth. One of the things I do, and I can pull up the spreadsheet afterwards if there's interest, is I've made spreadsheets where I've had one row be number of attendees, I'm like 100, 150, 200, 250, and then down the right, I'll have down the column on the left, I'll have increasing membership costs, so like $30, $35. And then I'll multiply them and make a nice grid. And then I can start looking at numbers and be like, all right, if we get 300 attendees at $50 a shot, this is how much revenue we'll have. And just looking at that and eyeballing that, you can start to think about, well, you know, what should my budget be? And for budgeting and first year cons, like, you don't have to be in a Westin. You shouldn't be in a Westin, because Westins are really expensive four-star hotels. You could be in a Holiday Inn Express with two function rooms. That is fine for a first year. Because first year you're going into it, expectations are low. And if you're like, we're at a Holiday Inn, we're at a Best Western, people are generally okay with that. Well, I just saw three hands at once. I saw you first.
Okay, yeah. Yeah, I noticed that 6-8 months in advance, they will do con registration and things like that. So that's a good generator. And you have the higher tiers. And I know AC limited, what is it, ultra sponsors, like 30, maybe 700 super sponsors, whatever it is. But you get some money that way, and you get it in advance. And you, like I say, you limit the amount of tiers, and certain people, like ultra sponsors, super sponsors, can get a good shot at, you know, getting into the West End over there. Yeah. So that's a good way to raise money, is months in advance to have people sign up for the con, and then later, of course, book the rooms. I mean, no, what is it, late January, early February for July for AC?
Yeah, pre-reg is a great way to get money and to tie it, and the larger cons often do this where hotel rooms are more in demand. Use pre-reg to bring in money, and one incentive is if you pre-reg, you can book a hotel room when opening happens. You can do higher levels of registration, but for smaller cons, you do want to be careful. Like Ultra Sponsor was mentioned for AmproCon, well, that's $1,000, and that gets you certain things that smaller cons can't necessarily provide, or at least it's less meaningful. Like I think Ultra Sponsors at AC, one of the things they get is a front row seat at all the shows. For a con of AC size, front row seats are great. If you got a con with 100 people, front row seats a little less meaningful. You probably don't want to charge $1,000 for that, because people will look at you kind of funny when you ask for that much. But higher tiers of membership and thinking creatively can help. For example, Pennsylvania has really throwback liquor laws. You can't have fun in the state of Pennsylvania. And I know, because I've lived in that state my entire life. Michigan, on the other hand, has much looser liquor laws, and something that Furry Connection North did back when it started, and that con's no longer around, it started in the mid-2000s. If you bought a sponsorship, they had cakes of beer in the sponsor suite, and you could help yourself to beer, and we sold so many sponsorships, and that was very specific to the state of Michigan, but other states may allow similar things, so, yes.
What causes a con to fail?
Do you want the short list or the long? The question was, what causes a con to fail? Finance can be a big driver of that. If you overspend and you have less revenue coming in, you could become insolvent very quickly. One example, I think it was a certain con that's not around anymore. They signed a multi-year hotel contract, but in the hotel contract, they assumed increasing attendance every year, and a couple years in, they had a shortfall, and the way hotel contracts are usually worded, if you have a shortfall, you have to pay the difference. And if you start to do the mental math, it gets horrifying very quickly when you multiply, say, 200 room nights times $200 a night. That gets scary very quickly. That can very quickly kill a con. Overspending is a way to do it as well. You'll generally want a person with a background in finance who controls the purse strings, who is paying attention to what's being spent and what it's going into, because AV contracts can get very expensive. Catering with a hotel can get very, very expensive. At a property like a Westin, if, say, you have a catered dinner, $75 a plate is not unreasonable, and I would not be surprised if that number is higher with inflation. So things can get expensive. Conversely, does everyone know what corkage is, real quick? Go ahead.
The cost to open a bottle.
And more broadly, if you bring in outside food or beverage, the hotel will be like, oh, you're not buying that from us, so you have to pay us for that. And sometimes if you get, say, just a single catered meal, then the hotel is willing to turn a blind eye to things like that. So if you set a sponsor suite or something similar, they'll turn a blind eye to that if you're buying something from them. So that's one way to spend more to spend less, if that makes any sense. If you have a small catered dinner for, say, super sponsors, and then you have like a lounge of some kind, they'll ignore the lounge because you spent money with them. So that's one of those weird finance things where sometimes spending money can save you money in the long run. Multi-year contracts with a hotel can help or hurt you. If you're doing year one, don't do a multi-year contract, or at least make sure there's an escape clause. All right, I see three hands. I'm going to start in the back this time.
How do you deal with legal and financial liability?
Liability insurance. Also to that point, there was a con that learned the hard way a few years ago. They got an astronomical quote for liability insurance, and it turned out the driver was when the insurer asked, what do you do at night? And they said, we hold raves. And it turns out insurance companies don't like raves. When they resubmitted it and they said, we have dances, the difference is about 5x cheaper in terms of liability insurance. But as for liability insurance, insurance companies will sell you liability insurance, and it's like, here are the dates of the event, you know, it's like four dates, and they'll cover everything that happens, and you get coverage pretty straightforward for millions of dollars. And pretty much every con I've worked at has had it. I know of at least one con where someone tried to sue them, and without liability insurance, it probably would have been mid-six figures for the legal defense, and with liability insurance, their defense costs were exactly $500, which was the deductible. The liability insurance company picked it up. And very early on, when this happened, they called the liability insurance company and they said, we handle this all the time. Here's a law firm. They'll take care of you. And they did. And what would have been essentially an existential threat for the con became a minor annoyance. So liability insurance, absolutely. And getting legal involved can help as well. And again, as we're speaking to a lawyer, it comes into play. They can help reporting on things like what we call the disclaimer of liability, and that will vary state by state. Pennsylvania, for example, did anyone attend AmperCon this year? Did you notice when you got your badge, instead of having to sign something, there was a little thing by registration that just said, by accepting a badge, you are waiving liability or similar. There should have been something next to each station of registration. That was Pennsylvania specific. We had a lawyer do research and he found case law where that was specifically used as an affirmative defense in a liability case. So AmperCon was able to do that. Not every state can do that. So definitely speak to a lawyer in your state. They may have certain guidelines, there may be certain cases at the state level. I saw a few other hands in the air. Di, I'm gonna call on you because I haven't called on you yet.
That's okay, thank you. You mentioned before about, you know, having, if you have a smaller hotel that might have a couple of function rooms, obviously better for smaller conventions. Obviously just having a couple of function rooms means you can't do things like panels, which you need smaller rooms and a lot more of them. How do you keep attendees entertained?
How do you keep attendees entertained? So dances are a big one. And this is, by the way, one of those things where it's like, how do we get people to come to our con and do things? And the base thing is, like, you can't control attendees. You can only incentivize and disincentivize certain behaviors. Like, you want them to fill a room, you have to give them a reason to fill that room. So in the evenings, dances is a really good example. But dances aren't the only thing. This convention in particular has a night market tonight. We also, I believe, animal music, and I don't know what night that is.
I think it's today, this afternoon.
Was it? Then I missed it.
You missed it.
I was busy staffing. you can do other things like dealer's room is an example, because if you have popular dealers like artists or fursuit makers and people will want to come to see them, well, now you have something that drives attendance. You know, stage shows as well. Think of people like Alkali, who you can put up on stage and they will get people to show up and see them. We cover musical acts. Sometimes it depends on the locality. MFF had an improv group called Too Much Light Makes the Baby Go Blind, and they had to rebrand for legal reasons, but they're still doing their improv thing at MFF every year. Having a guest of honor who's really popular is a great way to get people to attend. We had at Furry Migration, Gail Frostbane was our guest of honor, and she was like, oh, I can do panels and programming for you guys. And she did Fursuiting 101 and fill the room. So those are ways. Trying to think of other ways off the top of my head. I said dances, I said dealers, I said guests of honor. If anyone can think of anything else, feel free to shout it out. Anyone? All right, let's move on then. I saw some other hands who haven't, I saw that person in the back, go ahead.
Just going back on sort of the venues and the hotels, it seems to be, you know, most of the hotels that I've seen for cons, there's kind of three chains. You know, you've got Marriott, Hyatt, Hilton, and then everything just kind of filters down, like West End is Marriott, as an example. Are there any chains that you see that are more friendly towards for cons, ones that to avoid either contractually or, you know, ones that make horrific contracts you don't want to go anywhere to go near, or ones that you've seen really well with us?
No, I haven't seen any of that, and I think the reason for that is because money. Hotels started to figure out, I think as we got into about the mid-2000s, hotels started to pick up on, hey, these people spend a lot of money. And that was what got Amplicon into Pittsburgh. Pittsburgh actually reached out to us. I was on AC's board at the time. They reached out to us through the Convention Visitors Bureau, and they said, hi, can we host your event? And we've never had that happen before. And I'll get to you in a second. I saw your hand. I just want to acknowledge that. Hotels have picked up on these people spend money, and they don't cause nearly as many problems as certain other types of conventions, which will remain unnamed, because we generally don't trash the hotel. This might be strange for me to say, but we don't drink to excess, unlike some other kinds of conventions that are in hotels. So relatively speaking, furries are well-behaved, and is one reason we stress hotel behavior. Don't break the hotels, we like to say. And regarding the different types of hotels, I think what you may have been, this is adjacent to what you were getting into, there are star ratings for hotels in terms of amenities. And Westin is usually a 4-star hotel, and you can look this up online if you search for hotel ratings by stars. There's like 3-star, 2-star, 1-star. You think of like 1 and 2-star, that's like Econo Lodge, where there's absolutely nothing to do, and maybe 1 or 2 function rooms. Best Western might fall into that category. And then like 3-star, like the middle tier, like, maybe Marriott? I'm not sure. It's been a while since I've been at a Marriott. Hyatt Regency, that's more 4-star hotel. But they will take our money as long as, when negotiating, if you dress business professional. And like, I know the East Coast of the U.S. is a little more conservative. The West Coast is a little more laid back. But if you present yourself as a professional, they will be very, very willing to talk to you. And I saw your hand.
So I'm from New York. And I'm trying, I don't know, it has to be tried before. There's probably a lot of furries in New York, I would think.
New York City is freaking expensive, as
exactly,
I imagine you're aware.
Yeah.
So is Boston a little.
So my question is, Pittsburgh reached out to you guys for AnthroCon, right? And I've noticed, and it's probably not by a coincidence, or it's not a coincidence, but most big cities in the country have some kind of, furry scene, basically, or like conventions. Is it even worthwhile to consider creating a furry convention in places that are not, you know, the big cities of America?
I guess the question is, does it make sense to hold a furry convention in a more rural location?
Yeah.
If you have people, it does. And I'm going to use Minneapolis as an example. Minneapolis, with furry migration, I think we had about 1,400 last year. So even cons in the Midwest, like in the middle of the Midwest, like Minneapolis, they are growing. They're growing at a slower rate just because there's less people. This con, for example, A&E here in Boston, it is exploding, and it's partly because this is a very populated area, and assuming the same percentage of population are furries, that's going to need more furries. Like, we've just been hiring like crazy on our staff here. Furry migration, like, we have growth year over year, but it is slower growth. We actually had about 47% the last year. We went from 1,100 to 1,500. So that's a huge percentage in growth. It's just the overall numbers are smaller. But there's nothing that says you can't hold a con in the middle of Kansas, but the numbers are going to be smaller. And if you're not near a major international airport, you're going to see less international attendees. Like,
so there's a lot of factors to consider. You know, how do people come to our convention? How was the population of furries in the area? I mean, I know some people who flew from California to go to this convention. So,
yeah, now Boston has a major airport.
Yeah.
Logan is a major airport. Pittsburgh is a little less major, but it's major enough that we get people coming in from overseas, a number of countries every year for AmpherCon. MFF, well, O'Hare is, I don't think it's the number one airport anymore. I think it's slipped to number 2 or number 3, but like MFF, and it's not just planes. There's a lot of public transit, so people can take the train to, whether it's the local public transit or Amtrak to MFF. Like, I could if I was so inclined. It's also, it's kind of in the center of the country, so people could drive to MFF from, like, 12 hours in any direction. If you try driving to, say, Boston from 12 hours to the east, you're in the middle of the ocean, so that's not going to work so well.
Sure.
So yeah, if you're disconnected from a major airport, you're going to get more local attendees, less international attendees.
So my last question regarding sizes of conventions and the spaces that hold them. Would you ever be able to say like a ratio of function rooms to attendees?
I don't think I can give a clear answer on that because so many hotels are different. That would be an interesting research study though, just to see, to start crunching numbers. And I think that data is out there because conventions have their maps online. This convention has its maps online. Like if someone wants to start counting function rooms for each year from the convention's map and dividing them into total attendance, that could be very interesting. And I saw some hands. Did you hear him?
Yeah, I was going to say, first of all, for Boston, we got tons of colleges, so you know we're going to be huge.
Yeah.
Now, as far as New York City is concerned, for Apocalypse is maybe 35 miles from New York City. And if you want to go to a FurryCon, you got that. There's one starting up in New Jersey for the weekend or something like that. And then the one that got started up in Maine last year for Cajunland, 820 or so the first year. Not bad. Pretty easy to get to and so on. And when you're talking about trains, Stanford, you can take the train from New York right up there so that you can get there by, you can do that. So there's ways around. So even though Stanford isn't as huge city as you would think, a lot of New York furries probably head up there, and a lot of our furries go up to Portland.
And by the way, what do all those locations have in common? East Coast, which is
East Coast.
Populated. Now, an interesting thing I want to throw out. So I mentioned like AmproCon, big con, it's served by a major international airport. People come from all over. What's interesting is for a few years until it folded, for I think an unrelated reason, there were some furries in like Salt Lake City, Utah, that they actually held a small con on the same weekend as AmproCon, and they called it UnthroCon, and they wrote to us and asked us for permission, and we're like, this sounds amazing, go for it, you have permission. And it was for furries who couldn't make it to AmproCon. And the tone of the con, they had like maybe 200 people, they were very respectful about it because you don't ever want to like be seen as scheduling a con the same weekend as another con to mess with that con, siphon off attendees. But these guys were very nice and very respectful about it, and they were like, if you can't come to AmproCon, just come drive like an hour to our con. They had a couple hundred people turn out, and they kept it going for a few years. It was a neat thing. Do be careful if you're on the same weekend as another con, because especially if it's a bigger con. Like, imagine, if you will, if AmproCon and MFF were held on the same weekend. Now people would have to choose. No one would be happy. Both cons would be upset, and that would just be pretty awful. And I think I saw, all right, that hand first.
Yeah, two points. So the first one, the rooms. Okay. Majority of the venues actually post information about like size of the room, the capacity. So it's like if you wanted to do such a study as well, because like cons will post their maps, but they're not as complete. You know, it's like, for example, if this room has a capacity of 200 people, most probably maximum if people are standing. You can get all that information from their website and by contacting yourself. For the second point that you were talking about, regarding like if AmproCon and MFF were like on the same day, it's far worse than that. You know, it's like if two major cons are right next to each other, let's say there was a week difference, like people would still have to make a decision, because then it's a budget question.
Yeah.
So you still want to have separation and distribution.
Cool.
Yeah, now if it's two much smaller cons, like a couple of rolling beats, or even like a couple of cons with like 1,000 people each on opposite sides of the U.S., no issue at all, because they're just not going to influence each other. In fact, this con, when it was smaller, it was running on the same weekend as First Square up in Milwaukee. And there really wasn't any issue. In fact, I think the only person who regularly went to both cons was me. Like, I don't think there was any overlap between the two, so it's not a big deal. So smaller events being on the same weekend, as long as they're not physically next to each other, there's not going to be any major issue. I see a hand. I see a hand way in the back first, and I saw a hand in front. So let's do the hand way in the back first.
Yeah, how do you deal with advertising, and what avenues and platforms would you say are most successful in your experience with reaching out to the community?
Do you hate Twitter? Because I hate Twitter, but it's also really effective. And the question was advertising. So as far as advertising goes, we furries, we actually have kind of an ace in the hole for that, and that's called fursuit photos. When I ran Anthrocon's social media for a number of years, I started doing first and Friday focus because everyone else was. And something I noticed is like, you post a picture of a fursuit and you just have some reasonably clever quote that goes with it, and you're gonna get hundreds of likes and retweets. That basically becomes free publicity and free mind share. Even if you have a con that's not up and running yet, find some local fursuiters and build up some photos taken with them, like maybe at the hotel, for example, and you can start doing fursuit Friday photos, and that's gonna get likes, retweets, gonna get that engagement, and it's gonna get your name out there, it's gonna get mind share. You can also take out ads. There's, if you target them well, you get reasonable effectiveness on Twitter or Facebook, of course that costs money. Interesting thing that Furry Migration did that was a little thinking outside the box was they bought banner ads, which when they started, which you know, sounds like a strange thing to do, but they bought banner ads and they put them up on E621 of all the places. And they were advertising themselves as like a very, I don't want to say clean con, but they kind of said that without saying it. And seeing an ad like that on E621, like, shocked people, and it drove the click-through rates through the roof because people were like, this can't be real, I'm going to click on it. And Furry Migration got a lot of traffic that way. So sometimes doing something completely out of the box, putting up flyers and putting them out at other cons that are in the area, like I've seen a bunch of vacation land flyers at this con, which is a great idea because if you're a local coming to this con, well, vacation land up in Maine isn't that far away from you. So let's see, we got flyers, we got online advertising, trying to think what else there is. Those are the big ones. Like fursuit photos just are a great way to get attention because people love sharing and engaging with fursuit photos. So I would say that would be the number one thing to do, and there's very little cost involved other than time. So I saw your hand. Go ahead.
Yeah, I had a similar question about advertising, but I was more so asking when exactly should you start advertising your convention?
The sooner the better. The question was when to start advertising. Because some people work jobs where you have to put in for your days off, you know, many months in advance. It certainly varies. Yeah, some people can take the days with less time, but the sooner the better. You generally want to get that hotel contract signed many years out, and once you get into a regular cadence, you'll often, like, you get to Anthrocon size, you will have your dates out years in advance. It's not necessarily a full formal contract, like, you must give us this many nights, but it's usually at least something that at least blocks out that weekend for you, so you can put it on your calendar. So, what is this, 2024, I'd be shocked if Anthrocon did not have dates in 2028, for example, which is 5 years away. I think I saw a hand. Is that you?
Yeah, that was an expansion on the other question, but when in your process of forming the convention should you start advertising, hey, we're looking to form a convention, or you know, this is when it'll happen?
So there's kind of, I guess, the informal part and the formal part, and for me what kind of differentiates them when it becomes formal is when you are incorporated, like when you have that paperwork on file that lists who your officers are, which different states have different requirements, so as you said, president, vice president, treasurer, secretary. So that becomes the formal part. The informal part would be start talking to people, start staffing cons, or volunteering cons, staffing cons, make a lot of staff friends, and start making friends locally as well. Start floating the idea of, hey, I'm thinking about getting a con together, and kind of seed that idea into people's minds, get people thinking about it, and get that brainstorming process going. And in that process, I think you'll see some people are more interested than others, and maybe you start doing online calls on Discord or similar, and start kicking around some ideas, and eventually some sort of organizational structure will shake out. And like, just because you found the con, you may find that, hey, there's another person who's a really good person who should be con.